So following on from the kind of things I was reading out yesterday, you know, from that book of by Paul Pearsall, I'll do a couple of things, but from a different source, from something written by people associated with the HeartMath, which is about the energy of communication, you know, between people, and what's involved, and you know, that all of their research and their kind of focuses of those. This particular paper is called The Scientific Role of the Heart. It's all about communication. It's all about the electricity of touch, because they see these things in terms of electromagnetic energy, in terms of electrical potentiality, and you know, that's a way to interpret this kind of energy, but the energy that we know in the dancers, and they just give it these names really, but they are measurable. Says here, you know, the interaction between two human beings, such as the consultation between patient and clinician, or a discussion between friends, is a very sophisticated dance that involves many social factors. Most people tend to think of the communication solely in terms of overt signals expressed through facial movements. Voice qualities, gesture, and body movements. However, evidence now supports the perspective that a subtle yet influential electromagnetic or energetic communication system operates just below our conscious level of awareness, going on all the time. In every sense of a relationship, we meet in every time, everywhere we are. This energetic system contributes to the magnetic attractions or repulsions that occur between individuals. You know, it's like the ability to sense what other people feel or are feeling is an important factor in allowing us to connect or communicate effectively with them. When people are engaged in a deep conversation, they begin to fall into a subtle dance, synchronizing their movements and postures, vocal pitch, speaking rates, and the length of pauses between responses. And then, you know, their energies and their psychologies, you know, our energies and psychologies then become kind of synchronized in a certain way. You notice that. You notice people who know each other well, they always walk in rhythm. Same rhythm. People who are not getting on with each other, one's walking one way and one, you know, even though they're walking down the street together. You notice that with rhythms of body, and then, you know, notice people who are connected, they're just kind of in the same rhythm. The people who are well connected also can shift rhythms at the same time, and it not be you know, a problem for either person, because they've both got the same capacity to change. Rather than, you know, it causing friction, which can be helpful in relationships, because when it's not, then it's Let's see. So this also goes on about yesterday. Probably what I read out in summary yesterday was based on this kind of research, really. It's because the magnetic components of the field produced by the heartbeat. So we have to remember that, you know, we're not just, it's not just kind of energy, you know, random. It's a field that has a kind of a shape and a vitality in the field. And you know, in terms of the Curlian kinds of photography and things that are done, then those things could be picked up by machines. And when everything's not quite right, then the field is not right, and you can pick that up, and you could sense that in yourself. So you can sense the field is not right. The one of the things I did and have done many years ago was this thing called toning, and still do actually. But the woman, Laura Elizabeth Keys, said that, you know, the body is like a kind of field, and then that singing actually restores the perfect pattern of the field. It engages the heart, you know, with the voice and things like that. So the kind of things that we do in these dances and in the meditations, but particularly in this, and the singing and the way that we connect, this restores our kind of field. It restores our electromagnetic energy. So it isn't just that it's affecting our kind of brain, if you see what I mean. It's affecting our whole energy system, and that's why it feels good. So there are measurable effects that scientifically that then you can feel. So if we all had brain scans now, it'd be like, you know, or, you know, energy scans, then it's probably like, you know, there's that kind of evenness. We've probably all got similar kind of resonances and things like that, which accounts for it, you know. Doesn't necessarily last, you know. You wonder if the same people keep going on and on and on, like, you know, when you have camps and things like that, with all these big dance camps, those things don't seem to be sustainable beyond a certain length of time, I think, before all the other things start coming up. And this is where the surrender of the kind of ego sense comes into it, where we can, you know, surrender in, not into a kind of a loss of identity, but the identity that we surrender into is actually something greater. So we're not losing something, we're gaining something. So they say that, you know, all these signals that are communicated between people can be measured in biological terms as well. Signals and information can be communicated energetically between individuals, and they have measurable biological effects. And they this leads to a certain kind of synchronization between the people in their energies. You know, they also talk about this energy in terms of intuition as well. So it's like the kind of spiritual kind of aspects of all of these things. These people and others are dealing with them in scientific terms and from a scientific perspective, and coming up with the same conclusions or conclusions that are measurable and then can be applied in daily life. Because that's the whole point of the spiritual practices. They're applicable in daily life. You know, if they don't change our lives as spiritual practice, they're not working really. You know, we don't feel good in the long term. You want to say something?
Yeah, but you mentioned toning just now, and the fact that we sing all the time in these dances. I was just wondering whether singing the harmonies, which are often a bit intuitive as well, all part of this getting resonance with the physical sound we make with the other energy field.
Yeah, definitely.
So I think it's good that we could. I just wonder if we could make more of harmonies.
We can. Yeah. Well, I always encourage it. You know, when I'm singing harmonies, that doesn't mean I'm just the one that wants to sing it. It's kind of, it's like it's a signal for the most part for everyone to be able to do it. Because when people sing harmonies, you know, there was the first time I really experienced the power of different harmonies. I was on a yoga weekend and it was in somebody's house actually, but there were three of us men, as it happened, three men in this group. And we each sang a different harmony when we were doing this chant. And then the difference of that harmony was something that went like that. It pulled everything together, you know. It's, and it was really a tangible, this was like, I don't know, 30 years ago. It was really a tangible, wow, thing, because of the different, we each sang a different part. We didn't work it out, we just did it, you know. But it did something like it to me inside. It was like, it was like, you know, shivers down the spine thing, and you're kind of sitting in that kind of energy and just like wowing it, you know what I mean? And that happens all the time, but, you know, it happens still. There can be dramatic effects, I find, when I'm singing. You know, it's like, when we said, you know, when you know you're singing, then you're not singing. Or when you know you're dancing, you're not dancing. It's like these things just kind of creep up on you. But harmonies are great. That's the whole thing. And that's another thing about the, you know, when, you know, different genders are singing, male and female voices. And you listen and then they do different parts. That has strong effects as well energetically. They could be quite dramatic. You could make more of that, I guess.
Mm.
I think also that is it not the case that energy patterns are replicated throughout the universe?
Mm.
I think sometimes the part energy is shown as a sort of donut shape,
mm.
which is the shape of the planetary thing.
Yeah.
So that you get an interconnection of the patterns of the energy fields.
Yeah.
Right through the whole, all the systems.
Yeah, exactly. And everyone's energy field is not an isolated field. We're all connected into something that's greater. Even though, you know, we look at this physical thing, the matter, the material world. But, you know, it's no different from the energetic world. And then also that the energetic world, so to speak, all the information is communicated in that way. And then what we have as forms just isn't apparent. That's why you can call it an illusion. It's not an illusion in one sense, but it's no more real than anything else. It's just we focus in a certain way. And then we can focus in a different way and everything's different. So this is what these Zen Buddhists then, it's like enlightened, you're like, Sokyan Sasaki, you know, he gives a talk and he's going on about, you know, what's the point of these religious people, you know? They do all these kinds of things, you know, they kind of do ceremonies, they do chants, they do, and the priests and everything. But they talk about this, you know, they have faith and they talk about this, you know, God reality. Because he talks in terms, although he's Zen Buddhist, he generally talks in terms that people will understand. So he talks in terms of God, actually, quite a lot, because he knows people understand that. So he in America, as was at the time, and he says, well, but they don't actually have the reality. And so it's like you think, well, why are they doing it if they don't have the reality? Because it's like it's just they're kind of out of it. But he said, but I have that reality. He said, you know, it happened to me and I'm in that reality, and in this reality it's the same thing. And I've never left that reality, he said, since he found it, since that enlightenment. So that's the thing. You know, we may have glimpses of it, or, you know, and some of them last longer than others, both in terms of just a kind of insight, but also in terms of the actuality of it. But then it does, until it lasts, then it's not, we haven't got there where those people, you know, say it's possible to kind of hang out, really.
Mm.
So, it's interesting.
That's the difference between Howell and McCann, isn't it?
Yeah, in a way, yeah.
Howell is a temporary experience and McCann is a state that you've reached.
Yes, and then you're not going to kind of lose that state. Well, unless something drastic happens. It's a slippery slope, actually, as the people say. You know, the kind of way along the spiritual path, you can lose it all. You know, depending on what happens. As I always say, these things can go either way.
It's true. Or the third way.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Where the unknown.
Yeah, no.
But the thing is, if you know something, you can't unknow it. So. How can you go backwards?
Well, if you do know something, you may not know it well enough, or you know, it may not be the reality that you can hold on to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Depends what place of knowing we're really at. I mean, once you do know something, you know, and you don't know why you know, but you know that's true. But that is often relative too, because that changes, you know, what we think we know and what we kind of feel we know. When we become aware of other things, then it's different. That's you know, it's like we don't start off. I always kind of maintained when I started leading dancers, I didn't really know what I was doing. I knew what I was doing in the sense I was leading dancers, and I knew that it all felt good, but I didn't know what I was doing or what was happening. And it was only as I just like took it had such a kind of dramatic effect on me that it was something I just had to share with other people. You know, there was no doubt about it. This person here just had that effect, and it was like, you know, that was it. I was doing it. And you know, it was blissful ignorance in a sense, but you know, the not knowing actually and not thinking about it helped, because I didn't need to know, I just did it. And it was only when I started working with people where I had to kind of articulate what I was doing that actually then it dawned on me what I was doing, and then that, you know, that increased, and that's an important aspect. But what I think I'm doing is always changing. Yeah. It's not fixed. You know, things are different now in the way I work and internally, and also, you know, perceptionally, you know, in terms of what happens. It's different now from the way it used to be, as other senses open up. But it's everyone's potential. And Meshed Sam's big thing about the dancers, particularly as Sadie mentioned yesterday, the dancers and the walks were the kind of the culmination in a way of all of his spiritual work in that lifetime, but also others. You know, he came through with all kinds of faculties in terms of his ability to, you know, read the cosmos, his ability also to kind of understand all the scriptures. He was able to kind of read the Bible like and understand it at, like, was it 3 or 4 or something?
Something apocryphal, like, or not.
That's
what his mother supposedly said this.
So. Oh, okay, yeah. Maybe
you
these.
Have to believe his mother.
Yeah, maybe. Well, yeah. Wally Ali, you know, one of our senior merchants, is preparing in great depth the biography of Meshed Sam. He's a whole team of people, and they're all kind of working, and he's going through stage by stage, you know, the different aspects of the life, and it's going to be it's going to be like a fantastic thing when it comes out for those of us who are interested. But you know, the culmination of his work with the dancers and the walks was that everyone could experience these things. So when he was talking about dances of universal peace, it was like that peace, you know, that pervades the universe, that everyone can touch through these practices. Mm-hmm. That's the potential of them. That was what he worked on. Yeah. And they were the seeds he sowed in a relatively short time. It was only like 3 or 4 years he actually was doing dances.
Yeah.
And then other people have carried them on and in some ways have taken them further. And in other ways, those things that he did, they've not been taken further.
No, they're sort of standalone in many ways. Energetically.
Yeah, yeah, energetically, definitely.
Yeah, it's very interesting about that.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm just rabbiting on that. So if you want to say something.
One thing I want to mention about chanting and say when you're chanting on, or when we're chanting on our own, the other factor with the chanting mantra or the sorts of things that occur in the dances is the overtone effect, which some of us have found on our own, just chanting on one note. Mm. You don't have anyone else to harmonize with, but all of a sudden you start to hear this higher tone. I think a number of people have experienced that. That is, there are several ways to do that, but the most helpful and more useful way is to center the sound down here rather than in the head. It's easier to go to a weekend workshop and learn to center, you know, overtones in the head. That's just a resonance in the sinuses, essentially. But the resonance down here is much more helpful. It seems as though, from the research that I looked into, what we're actually hearing, there's a whole spectrum of sound in any note, and we only hear a part of it at any particular time. When we begin to hear those higher tones, those overtones, it's a resonance in the inner part of our ear. And that relates to the innermost part of the ear. There's like a small sort of crystalline structure. And the innervation to that is the nervous sort of connections to that, go all the way down to this area, to the thymus gland, which is, of course, very essential for the immune system. But it's also very much connected with this part of the body. You could say it's right where we call the heart center, even though the heart is actually, you know, to the side a bit. So this overtonal effect is also bringing us into sort of a harmony with ourselves, a resonance with ourselves. And it's not something that you necessarily try for, except that certain sounds will bring it out. But it's more like you sort of, like Meshed Sam describes, you sort of feel yourself in the all to start with, and then just sort of hear it, and then let the sound as though come through you, as though it wasn't even your own, well, as though it's the voice of the universe coming through your voice, so to speak, is what he recommends, essentially.
Yeah.
And all these long vowel sounds that we do, you know, Allaha and Ram, and, you know, with the rolled consonants around them, these sorts of Ahura Mazda, Elohim, you know, all these, doing all of these slowly on one's own is a wonderful practice in itself. And you only need one note to start with. And as has been said, one note is always in tune. So you don't have to worry about being out of tune, because one note is always in tune.
Although one note is never just one note.
Exactly, but one note is never, but we
but
hear it.
But it is in tune.
It is in
because
tune.
Because essentially the harmonics, they're just like, you know, you would sing harmonies. The overtones are harmonic overtones, but another octave higher.
Mm-hmm.
Although Tibetan chanters, they do undertones.
Yeah, they do. It's
so amazing. If you, but it doesn't do their vocal cords much good.
No?
No, have you ever heard most really? Tibetan people speak who do that?
That's right. I see.
They're not. So if you listen to those the three note chords the Tibetan people mm-hmm. can do, that's quite dramatic, because there's the kind of main note, the higher octave, and then this lower octave, and it's like it's that kind. It was similar to that thing, the chord that I said we achieved, those three of us with relatively low notes, but one really low.
Uh-huh.
The three of us took that to get it to happen, but these Tibetan people could do it on their own.
Yeah,
I actually tried to get one to teach me one, and they wouldn't do it.
No, they don't like to do that. It's true. And it's not probably not that essential, really. No. Do you have any sort of sound practice we can do that you?
Enjoy. Certainly, yeah, we could do. Who is very good for overtones?
Who is very good?
The a room other than this would
yeah,
you'd be able to hear the overtones
that is
in
true.
The room. Because then the sound would bounce off the ceiling, but here it doesn't. It goes up and doesn't come back out.
Yeah, we analyze dance spaces by the ceiling now, and by the acoustic. And so whenever someone's preparing a workshop for me, I ask them to take a picture of the floor and the ceiling. I'll approve or not approve the venue.
But let's, mentioned Sam's practices are simple, and we've done them at different times. There's the al, there's the la, and the uh-huh. who.
Yeah.
And each syllable, ala who, but each is like it's a whole range of movement in the kind of vocal cord, but in a slow way. So it's So you're not emphasizing al or al. It's like you're trying to get the whole range of the
spectrum,
sound.
Yeah.
And then you can hear overtones pop out. And overtones happen actually when two people sing and the notes hit together, then the overtones are produced. Mm-hmm. They're not just produced by the individual.
Yes.
You'll hear them in the circle in a good room. You can hear them on recordings as well. Some of the things that on my recordings, they all seem to pick out the overtones.
Mm-hmm.
So let's do this al, and then the la, and then the who. We do it just three times. And, you know, you can we've kind of created us. If you were doing this on your own, and it's, you know, it's I'd actively encourage people to do this kind of thing on your own. Give yourself, you know, some space where you settle down, and you do it from a relaxed place. I mean, we're in a relaxed place and we're in a relaxed space. And then, you know, check in with your breathing, you know, feel that you're relaxed as much as possible in the upper body. You're in a good, strong position, you know, that can hold the form of a body in a certain way. It can be seated on a chair, but it can also be on the floor. It doesn't necessarily work so well lying down doing this kind of thing, because you need the resonance all round. you have this sense of the front and the sense of the back. Shoulders are relaxed, you're not like this, you've got space underneath the arms and everything. And, you know, you can feel the breath is easy. And with all of these things, you breathe in a natural way. You're not trying to take in as much air as possible and then, you know, strain with the sound coming out. It's only what's natural for, you know, just like a reasonable breath, but no more than any bigger normal breath as a rule. There's a lot of sound that could come out with a normal breath before you need to breathe. So just, and usually you would choose your own note, and that's easy to do when you're on your own. Because, yeah, but experiment on your own with like the pitches, because you'll get different resonances with different pitches. And then some of the pitches that you get, you'll feel it, it's doing more than others at that time. And that so, you know, feel different vibration in different places. And feel the sound for these particular practices in the heart. So that is all of this space. In the rib cage itself, in the rib cage, above, below. It's not limited to that, but it is that. So enough chat. So I'll three times. Breathing in. At the end of each intonation, you know, let yourself breathe and relax before you breathe in. Again, if you're doing this on your own, it's the best way to do it, so that you then start from scratch with a kind of easy breath. So breathing in. Sometimes good to swallow at the end of a repetition as well, to make sure the throat is relaxed. And once more, breathing in. And then the la is a different sound, because you begin with the vibration in the heart and then it goes out more. The al comes from outside in and ends up with the vibration in the heart. So this time it's more a la and al in that sense. So la, like so. All together breathing in. So you can become aware, the more you do this, of the kind of subtle kind of movements of the kind of mouth and the vocal cords, to where the sound, it kind of evolves into one aspect. So in this, the la, it opens up, and in the al, it kind of comes in. So it's all very subtle movements in the mouth, and being aware of those, it's not, you know, you get used to feeling it, but you know, you can feel that you don't have to open up all the sound at once, and you don't have to take in all the sound at once. It's a different thing. And then the hu is a kind of balanced place in the middle, so can be a kind of to-ing and fro-ing energetically, but we'll feel the hu now. We'll do that three times too. And with the hu, if the lips are not too far apart, that helps. But again, place the sound in the heart, and in the back also, in and in the rib cage. So. So that practice, simple though it is, there's enough in there to keep someone going for years in developing the voice. Murshid Sam calls that spiritual training through music, in an evolving way. You know, it's a daily kind of practice, just as long as that, but getting something more out of it. Also, you know, the voice is a barometer for, you know, the way we're feeling, you know, the energy, and a barometer of the soul, Hazrat Ayat Khan calls it. You know, you feel how your breath is through your voice. You can feel how you feel how your health is through your voice. You feel that through other people as well. You can tell, you know, how their voices are, how they're feeling. And things. But you will know, in terms of my own vocal exercises, which I don't do so often now, but in a daily basis. But you know, I began with Om and did that for years, every day. That was the thing. And then this Allahu actually for a long time afterwards, when it was first introduced to me by Sadhguru. So simple things, but simple is best in terms of the practice. And it's not singing on your own. It's not like it's an isolated activity. I didn't find it's something that unites with all kinds of things. You know, unite yourself, body, heart, mind, but you also feel connected outside.
Yeah.
It's a magnificent practice for those who are vocally inclined, as I obviously was and am.
I still do the course of this once in a while.
Yeah.
6 weeks of it. Yeah. 40 days of this will do very nicely, actually.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah.
That's it. Tea break.
I think it is tea break time.